Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journeys. I'm very pleased today to introduce KJ Erickson. KJ is founder and CEO of Simbi, an innovative technology platform that allows users around the world to exchange or barter services. Users can do exchanges directly or in exchange for credits that can be spent in the Simbi network. Prior to Simbi, KJ spent 9 years as the founder and executive director of Forge, a nonprofit that provides education, skills and training and entrepreneurial resources to more than 70,000 refugees in war-torn Africa. She's won many awards for her work, including the Scholes Scholarship for Social Entrepreneurship, the Do Something Award for Public Service, and the Stanford Haas Public Service Fellowship. PopTech has been catalyzing social impact for 2 decades via its renowned fellows program, incubated initiatives, thought-provoking salons and conferences. The PopTech 2017 conference takes place October 19th to 21st. You can book tickets now and find out more information at poptech.org. So welcome to the podcast, KJ. I'm very much looking forward to talking to you about the work that you're doing, your experience as a social entrepreneur, and your aspirations and plans for Simbi over the coming years.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So can you tell me a little bit about Simbi, what it's about?
Of course, yeah. So Simbi is it's a network to exchange services without the need for anyone involved to have the dollars to afford what they're getting through our platform. We have 85,000 different services available. You can get anything from a ballroom dancing lesson to an SEO consultation to a logo designed for your business. And you do that by offering your talent or service into the network. So you can trade directly with people, or you can offer your service in exchange for credits that then you can spend on any of those 85,000 other services.
Right, right. And why did you set this up? I mean, what's the problem, the underlying issue that this Simbi is looking to, you know, help with?
Yeah, so I mean, we are living in a time where the economy is changing rapidly and the nature of work is changing as jobs are increasingly automated, as there's more corporate wage pressure and people are really struggling to get by. They might be able to pay for rent and groceries, but they often then have very little left over to invest in themselves, in their children, in their health, in learning, in the things that make life feel abundant. But they often have time and skills and a willingness and a desire to help other people. And so we're really creating a parallel economic structure in which people can take advantage of that which they do have to offer, and in return receive some of these things that make life a little bit more worth living.
Right, right. So great vision. And how long have you been doing this, and how many people are engaged and involved now with Simbi or use the platform?
Yeah, so I've been at it for over 2 years, and the platform has been live to the public since January of 2016. So we're getting a little bit of a history under our belt now. There's, well over 100,000 people using it around the world, although we're mostly in America and increasingly Canada. But it's really borderless. You know, as long as you can speak English, you can interact with and exchange value with people all over the planet.
Right, right. Now, what's your background? Because you've already been worked as a social entrepreneur, as an engaged social activist, I guess. Can you talk a little bit about that, maybe, and how, you know, about Forge and the journey you've been on?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I started as a social entrepreneur, although the term wasn't really around at that point. It was kind of just coming out. When I was 20, I was a sophomore at Stanford and had spent some time in a refugee camp in Botswana. And it was while I was there that I saw the ways in which the UN system was really poorly equipped to handle the unfortunate reality that refugees spend on average 9 years living in camps. And the UN really only has the money to pay for the humanitarian services, like getting them a roof over their heads or a tent over their heads and some food. And I just saw this huge opportunity to work in refugee camps, providing basically the human and economic development services that the UN couldn't afford to provide. So I ended up starting an NGO, an organization called Forge. We built libraries, computer training centers, did microfinance and agricultural finance programs. We built schools and much more, basically trying to fill this gap so that while refugees were in limbo in this time in their lives, that they were still receiving the type of human development that would allow them to return to their home countries and be contributing citizens. So obviously I was very young when I started it. It was my first real job. By the time I was 22, I had 200 employees and we were serving 70,000 refugees a year and highly operational, but also, relatively dangerous environments. Made a ton of mistakes along the way, but was extremely inspired by how much could be accomplished, especially for, for underserved populations. And that was, I ran it for 10 years. That was my start of my journey as a social entrepreneur. Decided that I probably didn't want to do things that were dependent on philanthropic fundraising in the future. Moved on. After a while, I took a break and started a yoga studio up in Northern California, where I'm from, just as a time to recover. And it was while I was running this yoga studio, not making very much money at all, but I stumbled my way into this underground local barter economy where other people who were, struggling to make ends meet would walk through the door of the studio and say, like, look, I really can't afford the $100 a month for a yoga membership, but, I could be, I'm a chiropractor. Could I, like, give you an adjustment in exchange for a membership? Or could I work behind the front desk a couple of, days a week in exchange for being able to take classes? And I started saying yes to those things and soon enough was making more money or more value through these trades than I was clearing in profit on the studio. And so it all kind of connected back to my early experience with Forge, in which, working in the in these refugee camps that really are some of the worst economic environments on the planet, but seeing the ways in which when there's a lack of any kind of a government social safety net, communities can band together and provide that for each other, right? And so if you're a refugee and you're struggling, like you don't have the money to send or to, to pay for a visit to essentially to the emergency room, your neighbors will give that to you. And maybe you'll do something for them in return. And so the idea to me was like, oh, well, maybe we can bring the power of the internet to these ways that humans have, for throughout history, supported each other through the trading and transacting of value outside of a traditional functioning monetary economy. And so that was the early days for Simbi.
Right. It's a great vision. Great vision. And I guess we've had barter economies before, haven't we? And we've moved to economy with money. And of course, it's got all kinds of challenges. But I guess it also allows you, there's a fungibility and people can, buy things where there might not be a coincidence of wants, or where people have, at the same time, the same needs for each other's services. So I'm just wondering, to what extent is that an issue? To what extent do you see this on your platform? How would you measure something like that? Is that an important question?
I think I misunderstood the question.
Yes, maybe you did.
I guess
the question is, if I want to go to the dentist and let's say I am a plumber, I may not find an exchange. So that may not be possible. So to what kinds of transactions or what kinds of scenarios are most open to barter, do you think?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the most common misconceptions about SMBE is that you have to have a direct exchange where, person A gives person B a service and person B gives person A a service. What actually happens on SMBE for the majority of the deals that get done is that we use our own internal credit system or currency to facilitate the transactions. So person A gives person B 10 SIMB in exchange for a service. And then person B uses that to get what they might want. So it's its own internal economy. And of course, you can do a direct barter or direct trade, but the fact that we have this platform and this network allows for there to be exponentially more possible transactions occurring than would be possible if you had to have a perfect direct barter.
Right, direct barter, that's the word I was the phrase I was looking for.
Yeah.
And what percentage then, and that's that would be a small percentage of the overall number of transactions that the direct barter.
Correct, correct. It's less than 20%.
Right. And tell me about setting the organization up and how that was. You mentioned you worked as an NGO in it before. This is a slightly different world, I guess, social entrepreneurship. And what's your funding model? And that would be a good place to start.
Yeah, so I mean, we're much more of a social enterprise. It's been funded mostly by angel investors. And, when you're starting something that's kind of audacious, like this idea, you have to start small and you have to prove yourself out as you go. And so I started just by raising a little bit of money from mostly friends and family, people that I'd worked with before and that believed in me, and to build an original prototype. And then turn that into a little alpha test where, got 100 people on the platform and was able to prove out the ways in which all this new economic value was being created. And then from there, started raising a little bit more money and it kind of expanding the pool as we had these learnings and this traction under our belt. So yeah, it's been investor funded.
Right, and how do you make money?
We don't right now. There's lots of possible directions for how that might be possible in the future, but this is really one of those enterprises in which you focus on building the network and building the amount of value that is transacting through the platform first and foremost. I think because it is a network effect business, because every additional person that we get involved in the service makes the service more valuable for everyone else. We're just trying to make sure that we don't do anything to get in the way of that kind of growth and value creation by charging for it, et cetera. And that once we get to the kind of size and scale that we very much believe we will get to, that there are business models, obvious business models that you build on top of it.
Right, what kind of things are you thinking of?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the core ones, right, is that SMBE is used for skill sharing and learning as much as anything, and that is incredibly valuable to various groups, and then often to businesses or corporations. So we're going to be coming out soon with a groups feature that will allow people to create a version of SMBE. For whether it's their local neighborhood association, maybe their university, et cetera. But then there's also a strong use case for companies that want to encourage sharing of skills and on-the-job training, et cetera. And that we believe will be excited to pay for that as a form of employee development.
Right. And you mentioned you've got professional investors involved. How did that go? The idea that you'll have a business model later when you reach a certain scale and things, because it's
Yeah,
presumably challenging
I think it's a very unique. You have to have the right business to be able to do that, right? And it almost inherently should be a network effect business, and it has to be one in which the potential is extremely large, right? So I don't believe that it's like a direction that any business model can go in, but it's one that worked for us.
Right. It sounds like you have a great vision for the future. I mean, what? How big can this be? How big do you think Simbi can be?
Right. I mean, philosophically, right? It can be as big as the economy, right? As I said, the value of the network or the value of, say, of our credits, is inherently as valuable as how widely you can spend them, and to what level of quality and trust and the reliability of our ratings. So for each additional data point we get on a person who's part of the network, their quality, their reliability, and then of course for each additional service that's brought on, the whole network gets more valuable. So that there's not a built-in philosophical limit to the expansion potential.
Yes. I guess when you're thinking of the underlying issue, and you mentioned, some people that they've got the time, but they don't have the resources and so forth. Presumably, that's I mean, not the dominant part of the economy. And to what extent are there? Do you find the kind of skills that are coming onto the platform? Represent, skills which are less tradable or less, more challenging to, for example, if you are a, a corporate lawyer, there's going to be no shortage of people looking for your, willing to pay for your skills, presumably, or you're a surgeon and so forth. But then there are whole other areas, presumably, where part of the challenge is that the people who are looking for the what you've got are very widely distributed. So it's not that there's not necessarily a demand, but it may be
Exactly.
very fragmented.
Exactly. I mean, so I'd say we do both. We do services that are, very commonly traded in the traditional economy, whether those are blue collar, plumbing and mechanics, etc. But then we also, and probably even specialize in these services for which there's a lack of liquidity in the traditional economy, either because that it is hard to build a marketable business around it, the barriers to entry are high, etc. There I'm looking online right now and I see people who will plan your next road trip, for 5 Simbi. They'll do that. Or they'll give you an ecology and ecosystems tutor. That's just under my experiences section. We have all kinds of services that fall into the healing arts that often are there's a lack of liquidity in those markets or other kinds of learning, whether that's like a ukulele class or practicing a new language, etc. Some of these things are hard to build fully marketed, fully built out businesses around. But that, you still have a lot of talent in that area are very valuable to other people. And for a couple hours a week in order to get something that you would really enjoy in return, make a lot of sense.
Yes, absolutely. And to what extent, how much is local and how much would you say is national or international? In the sense that if somebody in California doing a transaction with someone locally or somebody or doing one in New York, do you have any kind of sense of those statistics?
So we have a lot of virtually completed deals. At least half of the services available on Simbi can be performed virtually, whether that's over Skype or the phone, or often through our messaging system. We see a lot of graphic design, we see a lot of business consulting, we see a lot of kind of life coaching related services. We also have an Etsy-like marketplace where art gets shipped in the mail. Having a lot of local density is very much not a barrier to accessing Simbi because the majority of deals done currently are done with people that aren't in your local area. But we also have a local chapter program where people can start basically a Simbi local chapter, start having local swap meets, etc., where they're really building this alternative economy in their hometowns.
Right, great. And how does the pricing work? Because I guess in many areas, you can pay different prices for things. You can have a pretty cheap lawyer, or you can have a top-end lawyer. Is there a how does the pricing work on Simbi, and to what extent can you measure? People might be, not having a right the right price, so they might have a really good service, but they might be overpricing and underpricing
I mean,
indeed.
the market determines the market clearing price, right? So we don't tell people what to price their services. It's entirely floating. We find that if you overprice, you won't necessarily get perfect feedback to know whether it's that your service isn't desirable, whether nobody's on here, or whether you just priced it too high. So people often come in and try to figure that out. But it's a proper economy, and there's an invisible hand that determines these things.
Right. Yes. And I guess quality matters as well. I mean, if somebody's charging more, if you've got a you want to feel confident that they are going to deliver a better service. How does that side of things work?
So I mean, we've put a bunch of energy into our ratings and review system. So every transaction has a rating and a review associated with it. People get rated on three different qualities: the actual quality of the service, the reliability of that person in delivering it and in their communication, and also their friendliness, because the kindness and the experience of interacting with someone on Simbi is a really core part of what we're building, and we believe that's a core part of the value that anyone gets out of any kind of interaction or transaction. So we provide an ability to rate on all of those metrics.
Great, great, very interesting. So, can you tell me about some of the challenges organizationally building up Simbi? What would you
Well,
say
let
are
me
some of the
see.
biggest challenges? I'm sure you could talk for a long time about all the challenges. Are there one or two things that you'd highlight that were really significant challenges?
Yeah, so I mean, what I would say is that the biggest challenge that I faced was that this is a very unproven, obviously, business model, but also idea and concept. Right. And so when I first started talking to people about it, they'd be like, wow, that sounds really cool. And also impossible. Right. Or some people who are a little bit more familiar would say, like, oh, I feel like there was a lot of people who've tried this and it's always failed. And then I'd push back on them and be like, who has tried it? Show me one good high quality attempt. And I'll be like, oh, well, I think there was something in the 90s. And I'm like, so do you think that now is like the 90s? Right? Like, how much has changed? Could we be ready for this again? And so there was a degree to which, one of the early challenges was just getting people to believe that it was possible. And the way that I approached that was to not get very attached to whether most people believed that it was possible, to focus on the steps that I could take to prove out, as I said, like each small step of the way, that what I had seen, both in the refugee camps, but then particularly in running this yoga studio and seeing this underground activity, was real, and showing the ways that you can prove your thesis, just starting at that like very first rung on the ladder and then building up from there. But I think it's very easy to get discouraged if you don't jump into like what is controllable for me right now, rather than getting like into kind of debating the merits of an idea back and forth over and over again.
You're right. So trying to get an understanding of what kind of evidence that would satisfy them, the people you're talking
Exactly.
to, what would show to them that that this was viable and this would work and so forth.
Yeah, because you don't really need, I mean, for me, it's just been like, I don't really need anyone to, it's not that I don't need anyone to believe, but the number of people that I need to believe is very, very small, right? At first, it's like, I need somebody else who's willing to build this with me to believe to a certain extent. right? That it may be possible. I don't even need them to believe, like, I know that this is possible, just that it may be and it's worth trying. And then I need a few people that are willing to provide funding, not even necessarily them fully believing, but also believing that if it is possible, if she can crack this, then it's amazing, right? Then it's worth it. So I think just figuring out how you're going to strategically get over those humps to prove out your idea in like ever expanding concentric circles.
Yes. Was there ever a worry in your mind that, you know, you might get this to the scale where it works at a yoga studio or, you know, three yoga studio size thing, but actually it's never going to get beyond a certain size? And it sounds from what you're saying that size and scale is a very important element in what you're doing. What put your mind at rest that you are going to get this to, the potential to get this to a really big scale?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that one actually does go to economic theory for me. Because the reason why I think I'm so attracted to building this company in the first place is the fact that it gets more viable every day. And so my fear, I don't have a ton of fear that the market is too small, because I believe that it becomes, even though it might not appeal to the most mainstream right now, if we do it right, it can become increasingly mainstream over time as people can understand the value that's being provided by something that might be like more alternative and more niche at the beginning. Yeah. So yeah, that part doesn't keep me up at night.
And what about support along the way? How important has that been? I mean, you talked about your very rational step-by-step approach to, you know, testing the idea and so forth. It is and you know this more than many, you know, having spent that time working in the refugee camps and so forth, it being a social entrepreneur or, you know, working in these environments is relentless. And, you know, you are, you know, get up tomorrow and it's another day and you've got to keep, you know, going in quite challenging circumstances. So what kind of support have you had, and would you recommend to others to get the kind of support that's necessary to try new things and build projects that are different?
Yeah, really important question. I mean, for me, it's been having a great team around me, and we've, you know, now been a few years. We've added people to the team, which has been fantastic. But we've had a core team building this. Nick and Carlos and Artem, now for a couple of years. And, you know, I think that, like, just knowing that you are kind of going to battle every day with the same people, is super important. But also, you know, I've been a founder, CEO, entrepreneur for my entire career. And so I think that, the only way to do that and, you know, to still be breathing is to learn how to manage your own psychology. And so being able to kind of step back from those day-to-day kind of challenges or crises and know how to keep yourself centered, keep yourself energized is, I think, like the master skill of being an entrepreneur.
A bit of yoga probably helps.
Yeah, yoga totally helps. Meditation helps. You know, eating well and getting a little exercise or sun or whatever it might be really helps. And encouraging that for your team and for them to be taking care of themselves. That's something I definitely did not appreciate in the early days of foundership, where I just like drove myself in the ground and then had to, you know, go be a yoga studio owner for a year just to recover.
Yes.
And so this time around, it's much more about like, we're running a marathon here.
Yes.
You're not going to like build a new economy from scratch overnight, right? Yes. Like this is going to be a long sojourn.
Yes. Now, you talked about the funding side of things. Now, presumably working in an NGO and you weren't looking for certainly equity investment and looking for angel investors and so forth. So you must have had to learn a lot to deal with this environment. Just wondering whether one or two insights into, you know, what tips, what to do, and what you've learned about fundraising.
Ooh, about fundraising. Good question. So, I mean, I would say that probably the most important insight into raising any kind of venture-related capital is that the possibilities for, you know, really large returns is what matters most, right? My Cindy is not a business where anyone looks at it and they're like, oh, okay, there's like a really high probability that you're going to get to profitability, right? It's you more look at it and say, okay, very risky, but if you do get it to work, this could be something that's hugely massive and transformative. And so that actually aligns really well with venture-related funding. And I think that's like kind of the first place where entrepreneurs need to start is recognizing that they need to make a case for how their business becomes massive if they're going to go for venture capital. Now, the great thing is that there's so many other forms of capital these days, right? There's equity crowdfunding that has much lower sort of requirements for what the possible modeled return might be, where you can really raise money from your community itself. And we're looking at seeing if we can enable that to allow our members to also become owners in the platform.
Right.
But, you know, you got to understand the incentives of the people that, you know, that you're asking to place their capital with you.
Right. Is that something you're planning? Because I know I spoke to Doug Rushkoff he's the author of Throwing Stones at the Google Bus. But there is this question that a lot of these platforms that the people who benefit are the funders, to the exclusion of the people who are actually part of the platform who are contributing the value to the platform. And this is a big issue. So have you concrete aspirations to include users in some way as a beneficiary?
I'm very actively investigating how we might be able to do some equity crowdfunding and turn our users into our owners.
Great, great. So what are your aspirations for the future then, the next 3 to 5 years?
Ooh, good question. I mean, we're just trying to continue to build this thing. The great thing about Cindy is that it's not about taking share of wallet away from like any other platform, right? Like things that get quote unquote bought on Cindy are very rarely things that would have been bought in the regular dollar-based economy. So anything that runs through our network is literally new value created, and we're shifting the demand curve to the right in the whole economy. And so I just want to keep doing that, right? It's just keep growing the value that we're providing to people and increasing the size of the network and expanding what is possible through our site.
Great. And have you plans internationally? You mentioned you have got international business.
Yeah, we got
already.
A lot of international users. And then the most exciting thing that we are doing is creating this this new groups model where you can essentially create a Cindy for your particular purposes, for your local neighborhood, group of friends, company, school, etc. And we want to let people who are already have some form of connection or affinity to each other be able to share their skills and resources in a much more direct way. So that's kind of the next rollout.
Brilliant. Great. Thank you so much, KJ. That's been fantastic. I wish you the very best of success with your future growth. It's a great vision. And thank you so much for sharing your experience and insights and hard-won lessons with inspiring social entrepreneurs.
Awesome. Really delighted to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur podcast. I hope you found this interview inspiring. Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com and subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts. SSIR has been serving global leaders of social change for almost 15 years via its quarterly magazine, online articles, podcasts, videos, webinars, and conferences. At its heart is a vision that collaboration between non-profit, business and government sectors is key to solving growing environmental, social and economic justice issues. Find out more at ssir.org.